Essay number 3. I have a thing for birds. I've been like that all my life. Seeing one fly by fills me with delight. Like most people, I wish I too could fly. And like most people, I often dream about exactly that. It's never an extreme kind of flying. More just a strong push upward and forward from my legs, a spread of wings, a long, slow, sweeping glide about 20 feet off the ground. Sometimes it's more a lightness, the ability to leap up off the floor and float up to the ceiling in a very large room, a gym, say. It all makes me feel strong and free. I've seen a number of unusual birds in my walks in Boyce Park, especially in the early spring before the canopy fills in, engulfing them in green so that just a song makes its way out. There is a pair of pileated woodpeckers, for example, that sets up there every year, tree-knocking explosively, flashing into sight from time to time. I heard that knocking today, very, very loud. I could triangulate its direction and height, but the actual bird was entirely masked by the canopy. That's probably what got me thinking along these lines. Last summer, I saw a scarlet tanager on several occasions, my favorite bird. On one walk, it seemed almost to be following me, flitting ahead from branch to branch, so out in the open. I actually felt that it was Carol come to walk with me, this rare bird that she knew I loved. It's only the second one I've seen. The first, I was maybe 9 or 10, at my uncle's farm. I was smitten by it then, so I got one of those life-size plastic bird kits and built and painted my own. The sleek torpedo shape, the smooth scarlet red, jet black wings, fantastic. I love that bird. For some reason, I believed that the word tanager had another N in it as tanager. One day, my sister, a couple of years older, corrected me. I was almost irate in my adamance that I was right, enough so that she backed down, no easy accomplishment. It wasn't until many years later when I was writing a poem with that bird in it that I realized I was wrong. Here are a few lines from that poem called Second Wind. Tonight, I dreamed my own death, escaping it, as always, narrowly. Now the sound of you breathing beside me, flocks of tanagers dreaming of spring. I smoke one cigarette, then another. The darkness floods my lungs. Earlier, while we were dancing, I caught my second wind and wished the lovely passage of breath through my chest would never cease. I have always taken this incident with my sister as an object lesson pertaining to personal commitment. You may think my takeaway is a simple one. Be more humble, open to criticism, ready to acknowledge mistakes. That's part of it. But I also see the opposite side. Be confident. Stand up for what you strongly believe. Don't back down until you see for yourself the error of your ways. I often say at work, to myself and to others, just because you're the only one saying something doesn't mean you're wrong. In fact, that's often a sign that you're right. Maybe just ahead of your time or not in the right place. That's not, of course, so with my tanager mistake, in which case I was way ahead of my time, but with the wrong answer. I call attention to this basic stubbornness because I was thinking on my walk today how out of step I've always been with the dominant trends in my field. I've written about this variously before, so I won't dwell on the specifics. I'll tell the story that crossed my mind while I thought about my "that's my spelling and I'm sticking to it" tanager. When I interviewed for my current position in 1981, I read an essay on metaphor for my job talk. The most fervent interrogator at these events was, I was told, a young, ambitious scholar with a forensic temperament, postmodernist in his ideology, the definition of a theorist. I knew enough about that stuff to stand my ground, but could have cared less then as now about my ideological purity or my up-to-the-minuteness. So I finished my paper, the question session opens, and he leans forward in his chair, which I had been told ahead of time was a precursor to his question. A dismissive one that ended with what I'm sure he assumed was a dagger thrust. Don't you think your position on this is nostalgic? Nostalgic, in that era, in his discourse, was shorthand for old-fashioned, naive, or maybe just stupid. I knew that. I told him then what I still think today. I do have a deep longing for a time that is not now, but it is not in the past. I have no interest in going back to anything. I'm eagerly, hopefully, eyes forward, to borrow a figure from Emerson. I long for two worlds. The one that is not here right now, because we have not lived up to the past promises of our own words, translating energy into fact. And the one that will be coming down the road once the current regime has passed, which happens to be the world just emerging now, one I feel much more at home in. I don't think he understood a word of what I was saying. It sounded almost insane, I suppose. It wasn't even theory itself I was waiting to pass. Much of that was timely, urgently necessary in the dreary critical and cultural landscape left to us by late modernism. A way of cleaning house, making room. It was the power dynamic it seemed to promote in our field, in the academy, an elitist, specialist culture, a book fetishistic economy of knowledge, a perfect reincarnation of everything that was wrong with the academic dynamics of the 1950s, the king we went into the streets to dethrone and behead, opening up so much vitality and user-friendly diversity in the university communities of the late 60s and early 70s. Then we, my generation, brought it all back. Except now we ran the show, ensconced at the top, the industrial-sized shredder of postmodernism, grinding up everything in sight until there was nothing left to demolish. All the kings and all their minions in bits on the ground. There were three choices then. Shut off the shredder and wait to see what came next. That would have been pretty neat. Have the shredder shred itself. That would have been spectacular. Or have the shredder look around and say, the king is dead. Long live the king, who in this case is even worse than the old king, because he denies he is the king in the very process of doing everything kingly. But back to the birds. This week, in our figurative language seminar, we were reading the work of some of the British romantics. So I was looking again at a couple of poems I know well, and I just happened to focus on the birds that make those poems work. One is Shelley's To a Skylark, an astonishing tour de force of romantic figuration. Here is the first stanza. Hail to thee, blithe spirit, bird thou never wert, that from heaven or near it pourest thy full heart in profuse strains of unpremeditated art. It struck me for the first time how odd this assertion is, telling this bird that it was never a bird, making my tanager mistake seem like chump change by comparison. All of a sudden, the skylark is entirely disenfranchised from his own birddom, at the poet's behest, reduced only to its song, wafting down from the clouds. I suspect there is a technical name for this specific kind of figuration, but I don't know exactly what it is or care enough to look it up. It's the act of radical disembodiment that interests me here, and what Shelley does with it in the rest of the poem, the array of similes he uses to refill the empty space his absent skylark creates for him, transforming the spectral song into the apotheosis of poetic inspiration. Slowly at first, in the opening stanzas, like an unbodied joy whose race has just begun, or like a star of heaven in the broad daylight, then cascadingly, like a poet hidden in the light of thought, singing hymns unbidden till the world is wrought to sympathy with hopes and fears it heeded not, like a high-born maiden in a palace tower, soothing her love-laden soul in secret hour with music sweet as love, which overflows her bower. Like a glowworm golden in the dell of dew, scattering unbeholden its aerial hue among the flowers and grass, which screen it from the view. Like a rose embowered in its own green leaves, by warm winds deflowered, till the scent it gives makes faint with too much sweet those heavy-winged thieves. Note that in each case, there is a thing there at the base of the comparison, but it's never quite tangible, embodied. It's always barely evanescent. The rainbow clouds, the hidden poet, the tower-ensconced maiden, the screened glowworm, the scented rose. Nothing solid anywhere, but still filled to the full. That's impressive. The rest of the poem then uses this refigured bird base to amp up things like Wordsworth's "Let nature be your teacher," and Coleridge's "Damsel with a dulcimer" to their maximum pedagogical volume. What the poet aspires to be, but can never even approach becoming. That's very cool, I think, at the material level of the poem. This bird that is not a bird, these things that are no longer things, inspiriting in the most majestic ways, haunting in the most alluring ways. The similarly disembodied figure of the poet who can only listen, listen. We look before and after and pine for what is not. Our sincerest laughter with some pain is fraught. Our sweetest songs are those that tell of saddest thought. Yet if we could scorn hate and pride and fear, if we were things born not to shed a tear, I know not how thy joy we ever should come near. Better than all measures of delightful sound, better than all treasures that in books are found, thy skill to poet were, thou scorner of the ground. Teach me half the gladness that thy brain must know. Such harmonious madness from my lips would flow, the world should listen then, as I am listening now. Shelley wrote this poem right around the time he wrote his hyperdrive starship of a defense for poetry, the apogee in my mind of romantic valorization of the power and force of both the poet as a cultural figure and poetry as a mode of discourse. Here are a few passages just to give you a flavor of Shelley's ecstatic paean. My favorite one comes about halfway in, the ultimate phallic analogy for verbal invention. Poetry is a sword of lightning ever unsheathed, which consumes the scabbard that would contain it. Yikes. But there are many others, more extended and wondrous. Poetry is indeed something divine. It is at once the center and circumference of knowledge. It is that which comprehends all science, and that to which all science must be referred. It is at the same time the root and blossom of all other systems of thought. It is that from which all spring, and that which adorns all, and that which, if blighted, denies the fruit and the seed and withholds from the barren world the nourishment and the succession of the scions of the tree of life. It is the perfect and consummate surface and bloom of all things. It is as the odor and color of the rose to the texture of the elements which compose it, as the form and splendor of unfaded beauty to the secrets of anatomy and corruption. Poetry turns all things to loveliness. It exalts the beauty of that which is most beautiful, and it adds beauty to that which is most deformed. It marries exaltation and horror, grief and pleasure, eternity and change. It subdues to union under its light yoke all irreconcilable things. It transmutes all that it touches, and every form moving within the radiance of its presence is changed by wondrous sympathy to an incarnation of the spirit which it breathes. Its secret alchemy turns to potable gold the poisonous waters which flow from death through life. It strips the veil of familiarity from the world, and it lays bare the naked and sleeping beauty which is the spirit of its forms. Poets are the hierophants of an unapprehended inspiration, the mirrors of the gigantic shadows which futurity casts upon the present, the words which express what they understand not, the trumpets which sing to battle and feel not what they inspire. The influence which is moved not, but moves. Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. Wow, can't go much farther out there than that. Shelley doesn't seem to be very widely read or admired these days. I've come to enjoy and respect his work more over the years, but there is something oddly cold in the overwhelming heat of his images, the glassy, almost dispassionate feel of the poetic surfaces, hard to penetrate, reminding me of Walter Pater's famous dictum, to burn always with this hard, gem-like flame to maintain this ecstasy is success in life. That is Shelley, exactly, I think. Burning, burning, yes, but with gem-like flames. No one in our seminar was a particular fan of Shelley's work, but everyone, to a person, liked Coleridge. And it struck me for the first time how warm Coleridge felt in the reading. No matter how odd or over the top he becomes in his poems or nearly unintelligible in his prose, he remains likable. One of the poems I ended up talking about, though it was not assigned, is Frost at Midnight, which has an owl in its opening and a robin in its closing. In between is that extraordinary meditation he engages in beside the flickering fire in his cottage, his infant son cradled beside him. I've always loved this poem, so elegant, soothing, poignant, and I've read it dozens of times. This time, I just happened to be thinking about Coleridge's early adulation of David Hartley's bizarre associationist system for orchestrating the relationship between perception and memory. Those tiny vibrations in the brain that sensations initiate to encode their presence, actual physical perturbations that can also be instigated in the absence of external stimulation, becoming disparate memories in the associative company of one another. The term association became a keystone to Romantic poetics. Wordsworth uses it multiple times in his famous preface, having simply absorbed it from Coleridge, I'm sure. And Coleridge, who really read Hartley, relies on it heavily to jog his thinking toward his definition of the imagination in his Biographia, though he has to recognize and then abandon Hartley's highly deterministic system very early in that process to get here. He says, "The imagination, then, I consider either primary or secondary. The primary imagination I hold to be the living power and prime agent of all human perception, and as a repetition in the finite mind of the eternal act of creation in the infinite I am. The secondary imagination I consider as an echo of the former, coexisting with the conscious will, yet still as identical with the primary in the kind of its agency and differing only in degree and in the mode of operation. It dissolves, diffuses, dissipates in order to recreate. Or where this process is rendered impossible, yet still, at all events, it struggles to idealize and unify. It is essentially vital, even as all objects, as objects, are essentially fixed and dead." This is the most exorbitant definition of the imagination I'm familiar with, and it comes out of nowhere in his argument. He's been trying to get to it for pages, chapters, the long Kant-like drudgery of his foundational thinking, striving, grappling its way toward where I'm sure he knew well in advance he wanted to get. Just before he announces the above proclamation, he clearly reaches an impasse and knew it. Most theorists at that point would likely just cover over the huge chasm from one paragraph to the next with an authoritative thus or therefore. I do it all the time. No one ever notices. Coleridge, to his everlasting credit, doesn't do that. I think it's actually because he believes that we, his readers, are smart enough to see all the steps that are missing, which we are not. Or at least I'm not. I would have trusted him, or been enough carried away by the fervor of his argument to overlook this crucial epistrophic moment. Coleridge does here the most charming thing. He inserts a letter from a friend that basically warns him not to publish that portion of the argument because it is both incomprehensible and inflammatory. His reputation will be marred. So out of deference to his wise reader, he complies. The letter, of course, we know now, was one Coleridge invented himself, and it's a wonderful bit of ironically deceptive rhetorical flourish, at least to me. Other readers might be less generous. I think it's a gas. In any case, while I was thinking through what I might say about Hartley in class, I recalled that Coleridge named his son after him, the child in the room with him the night he wrote Frost at Midnight. That's why, by this process of association, I decided to look at that poem, a kind of opportune excuse just to enjoy it again. Reading it this time, I couldn't help but see it as a literal enactment of Hartley's, or at least Coleridge's Hartley's, associative process. The poem starts outside with the frost, then moves transmissively via the owlet's cry inside the cottage to little Hartley, to Coleridge, meditating there in the silence until all the outside world is absent except for the little blue flame quivering on his fireplace grate. The frost performs its secret ministry unhelped by any wind. The owlet's cry came loud, and hark, again, loud as before. The inmates of my cottage, all at rest, have left me to that solitude which suits abstruser musings, save that at my side my cradled infant slumbers peacefully. 'Tis calm indeed, so calm that it vexes meditation with its strange and extreme silentness. Sea, hill, and wood, this populous village, sea and hill and wood, with all the numberless goings-on of life, inaudible as dreams. The thin blue flame lies on my low-burnt fire and quivers not. Only that film, which fluttered on the grate, still flutters there, the sole unquiet thing. Methinks its motion in this hush of nature gives it dim sympathies with me who live, making it a companionable form, whose puny flaps and freaks the idling spirit by its own mood interprets everywhere, echo or mirror, seeking of itself, and makes a toy of thought. That perception vibrates his mood and his memory, jogging him back to his lonely school days, watching that same fluttering stranger, a metaphor back then for the little blue flame. An elaborate series of associated memories ensues, concluding with his poignant hope that some actual stranger he knows, townsman, aunt, or sister more beloved, might show up at the door and rescue him from his solitary work. He says, "But oh, how oft at school, with most believing mind, presageful, have I gazed upon the bars to watch that fluttering stranger, and as oft with unclosed lids, already had I dreamt of my sweet birthplace and the old church tower whose bell, the poor man's only music, rang from morn to evening all a hot fair day, so sweetly that they stirred and haunted me with a wild pleasure falling on mine ear, most like articulate sounds of things to come. So gazed I, till the soothing things I dreamt lulled me to sleep, and sleep prolonged my dreams. And so I brooded all the following morn, awed by the stern preceptor's face, mine eye fixed with mock study on my swimming book. Save if the door half opened, and I snatched a hasty glance, and still my heart leaped up, for still I hoped to see the stranger's face, townsman, or aunt, or sister more beloved, my playmate, when we both were clothed alike." and instantly is back to himself and his son, for whom he has such loving and elaborate high hopes, a kind of long prayer that could never have issued forth had he not been transported first back to his own lonely childhood moment at school. He says, "Dear babe, that sleepest cradled by my side, whose gentle breathings heard in this deep calm filled up the interspersed vacancies and momentary pauses of the thought. My babe, so beautiful, it thrills my heart with tender gladness thus to look at thee and think that thou shalt learn far other lore in far other scenes. For I was reared in the great city, pent mid cloisters dim, and saw not lovely but the sky and stars. But thou, my babe, shalt wander like a breeze by lakes and sandy shores, beneath the crags of ancient mountains and beneath the clouds, which image in their bulk both lakes and shores and mountain crags. So shalt thou see and hear the lovely shapes and sounds intelligible of that eternal language which thy God utters, who from eternity doth teach himself in all things in himself. Great universal teacher, he shall mold thy spirit, and by giving, make it ask." The moment gradually emerges into this peroration, returning to the outside world and finally to the frost, this way. "Therefore, all seasons shall be sweet to thee, whether the summer clothe the general earth with greenness, or the redbreast sit and sing betwixt the tufts of snow on the bare branches of mossy apple tree, while the nigh thatch smokes in the sun thaw. Whether the eavedrops fall heard only in the trances of the blast, or if the secret ministry of frost shall hang them up in silent icicles, quietly shining to the quiet moon." The lovely circuit of associations closes where it opened, but so much more enriched, as is always the case with Coleridge, by its path of transit. In this case, the ministry of the frost having revealed at least a few of its beautiful secrets. A woodpecker, a tanager, a skylark, an owl, and a robin. A pretty good day for me with a bunch of birds. I can't remember any longer what I was trying to get at in this piece, or even where it started. That's the beauty of the associative process when you're walking alone in the woods.